The first toast at dinners following English craft lodge meetings is the Queen and the Craft. And on occasion one hears the question asked, why should it be given like this? Why not simply the Queen, in the way that's customary outside Masonry? And what is the reason for the Masonic form of the toast, and what is the history that lies behind it? In the past, questions about the validity and appropriateness of this form of the toast came up after the death of King Edward VII in 1910. He was the past Grand Master, who as King had enjoyed the title of Protector of the Craft, and then again on the accession of Her Majesty the Queen in 1952. Misgivings about the unique form of the toast used in Masonry seem to be on grounds of this sort. What, for instance, when the sovereign is not a Freemason, as in the case when George V succeeded his father who was, let alone when the sovereign is a woman, as at present, and during the reign of Queen Victoria? Shouldn't the toast be a general expression of the wider loyalty of all the sovereign's subjects, and not just that of Freemasons? And isn't the Masonic way of proposing the loyal toast a coupling together of the health of the monarch with prosperity to the craft? So, almost verging on les majesty, one might think. And anyway, why do we have to be different from everyone else? However, as I hope to show in the course of this talk, these doubts really arise from misapprehensions about the origin of the toast and misunderstandings of its meaning. The procedure was made clear for the English Constitution by a paragraph in the Board of General Purposes report adopted by Grand Lodge at the quarterly communication on the 5th of March 1952, shortly after the Queen had acceded to the throne on the death of her father, King George VI, who, like his grandfather before him, was a past Grand Master of the United Grand Lodge. The relevant paragraph of the Board report, which on its adoption thereby became an edict of Grand Lodge, said this: as there is considerable doubt in the minds of brethren regarding this matter, the Board wishes to make it clear that, in countries where the loyal toast of the Queen is honoured, the first Masonic toast should be the Queen and the Craft. This should be followed with Masonic fire where such is given. You'll no doubt have noticed the wording, in countries where the loyal toast of the Queen is honoured, and this, of course, was to cover cases of English lodgers meeting in parts of the world where there is a local loyal toast, which may take precedence over or actually replace the Queen and the Craft. A notable case nearer home, for instance, is in the two Lancashire Masonic provinces, where the toast takes the form traditionally observed in that county, the Duke of Lancaster. A recent pronouncement by Grand Lodge has clarified the procedure for honouring the toast and the singing of the national anthem. The toast is proposed, in other words announced, quite simply and without elaboration as the Queen and the Craft, whereupon everyone rises and sings the national anthem, after which they drink the toast and then give Masonic fire if this is also going to follow all subsequent toasts. So the sequence is this: propose, sing, drink, fire. Incidentally, I might observe here that it is not customary for the national anthem to be sung twice in the course of a Masonic gathering, so that if it has already been sung in the lodge room after the closing of the lodge, it is not sung again at the dinner table. So much for procedure. But why the Queen and the Craft? Well, the point is that we're not drinking the health of the sovereign as a Freemason, nor are we adding the prosperity of the Craft as a sort of rider to the loyal toast. The real significance of the toast with us has become that loyalty to the crown is an essential principle of the order. If you think about it, there's a link here with the charge after initiation, with its reminder of one's civil duties as a citizen of the world, and the sacred and indissoluble attachment one should have towards one's own country. Remember the familiar words, and above all, by never losing sight of the allegiance due to the sovereign of your native land, a sentiment which is repeated in the aims and relationships of the craft, as adopted by Grand Lodge, which you'll find printed in the preface pages of the Book of Constitutions. It might be of interest at this point to mention that the basis of what we now know as the charge after initiation is one of the earliest bits of authentic Masonic ritual that we possess. This is a piece entitled A Short Charge to New Admitted Brethren, which appears in Smith's Pocket Companion for Freemasons, a sort of Masonic handbook published at the end of 1734 or early in 1735. This was not in any sense an exposure, and although it was not an official publication, it was nevertheless authoritative. In this short charge to new admitted brethren of 1734, we find this. In the state, a Mason is to behave as a peaceable subject, conforming cheerfully to the government under which he lives. Now, this concept of loyalty as a duty of Freemasons is in itself an echo from the old charges, the constitutions of Masonry, which date back some 600 years into operative Masonry. The earliest of these documents were handwritten on parchment rolls or in vellum books. Later ones were on paper, handwritten again, or still later printed or reproduced from engraved plates. But they all have the same basic format, their principal contents being a long legendary history of the Mason craft, followed by a series of charges, hence the name of these documents. Charges, or rules, laying down a code of conduct for Masons, some dealing with moral and social behaviour, and others regulating their trade practices. These charges begin typically like this, and I'm going to quote from a copy of the old charges known as the Grand Lodge Manuscript No. 1, which was dated by the scribe when he had finished copying it out, 25th of December, 1583. It's the third oldest of these documents known to us today. The two earlier ones are the Regius Manuscript of about 1390 and the Cook Manuscript of about 1410, both in the British Library. But the Grand Lodge Manuscript No. 1 is appropriately enough one of the treasures of our own Grand Lodge Library. And it's an interesting point that although this manuscript was written during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, it nevertheless, as you'll hear, refers to the King of England, thereby showing that it was copied from a somewhat earlier original, now lost. The charges general in the Grand Lodge Manuscript No. 1 begin like this, and I'm abbreviating and modernizing the language slightly. The first charge is this, that ye shall be true men to God and Holy Church, and also that ye shall be true liegemen to the King of England without treason or other falsehood, and also that ye shall be true each one to another, that is to say, every mason of the craft of masonry that be masons allowed, ye shall do unto them as ye would that they should do unto you. This last another sentiment that found its way into the 1734 short charge to new admitted brethren, and from there eventually into our own charge after initiation. So there it is. The idea of loyalty to the king and loyalty to the craft goes right back into the operative masonry of the Middle Ages. But how, then, was the tradition transplanted into free and accepted masonry? And the answer is almost certainly through Anderson's Constitutions, our very first Book of Constitutions, compiled for the Premier Grand Lodge by the Reverend James Anderson and published in 1723, 6 years after the Grand Lodge had come into being. Anderson described his book as being a digest of the old Gothic constitutions, as he called them, of the operative Masons. And like these, it led off with a legendary history of the Mason craft, followed by a summary of the ancient charges, the ones that you will still find printed at the beginning of the Book of Constitutions, and then there was a later main section setting out the regulations enacted by Grand Lodge. In his history of the Mason craft, Anderson refers, and I quote, to the old toast among Scots Masons, namely, God bless the King and the craft. In his next edition, the new Book of Constitutions of 1738, this reference had become to the King and the craft, which, according to Anderson, was joyfully toasted by Scottish Masons in the 15th century. This Book of Constitutions also had a description in its historical section of the laying of the foundation stone of the new banqueting house for what, when it was begun in 1619, was intended to be the new Palace of Whitehall in London. However, the project was never completed. To quote Anderson's words, for want of a parliamentary fund, no more was built but the said glorious banqueting house, the finest single room of that large extent since the days of Augustus, and the glory of this reign. Afterwards the lofty ceiling was adorned by the fine pencil of Peter Paul Rubens. And that banqueting house, with its magnificent Rubens ceiling, still stands today, of course, in Whitehall. But I digress. In his description of the laying of the foundation stone, Anderson tells us that the king, it was James I, with Grandmaster Jones and his Grand Wardens, Grandmaster Jones was, of course, the famous architect Inigo Jones, and Anderson styles him as Grandmaster in the way that he does in his history of almost any note right back to Adam. So, the king with the Grandmaster Jones and his Grand Wardens, attended by many brothers in due form, and many eminent persons, walked to Whitehall Gate, and levelled the footstone of the new banqueting house with three great knocks, loud huzzas, sound of trumpets, and a purse of broad pieces of gold laid upon the stone for the masons to drink to the king and the craft. In a later chapter of the 1738 Constitutions, Anderson describes a similar occasion 100 years later, just after the formation of Grand Lodge. This was the laying of another foundation stone in 1721 for the Church of St. Martin in the Fields, but now at what is the northeast corner of Trafalgar Square in London. To quote Anderson again, it being a royal parish church, King George I sent his Lord Almoner and Surveyor General, attended by Brother Gibb, the architect of the pile, this was James Gibbs, with many Freemasons, in a solemn procession from the palace, to level the footstone of the south-east corner, by giving it three great knocks with a mallet in the king's name, and laying upon it a purse of 100 guineas, when the trumpet sounded, all joined in joyful acclamations, and the craftsmen went to the tavern to drink to the king and the craft. There's a similar account, too, from Ireland, in connection with the laying of the foundation stone of the Parliament House in Dublin in 1728, which is described in the Book of Constitutions, compiled by Edward Spratt as Grand Secretary for the Grand Lodge of Ireland, and again the proceedings finish with the Masons drinking to the King and the craft. So, more than 2.5 centuries ago, it seems that the toast to the King and the craft was already regarded as one of the time immemorial traditions of operative masonry, and it was being copied in speculative Freemasonry. When, in 1719, Dr. John Theophilus des Aguliers was installed as Grand Master, he, after being duly invested, installed, congratulated, and homaged, Anderson's words again, forthwith revived the old regular and peculiar toasts or healths of the Freemasons. And from then on there are many other references in speculative Freemasonry to the King and the Craft and other toasts, and it is apparent that by the middle of the 18th century, certain toasts were following a formal set pattern. Confirmation of this comes from an unexpected source, the Grand East of the Netherlands. As was the case in several other countries on the continent of Europe, Freemasonry had been established in the Netherlands as a provincial Grand Lodge under the Premier Grand Lodge of England, and still preserved in the archives of the Grand East is correspondence from England dating back into the 1750s, the time when the Netherlands were seeking Masonic independence from England as a sovereign Grand Lodge in their own right. In that correspondence preserved at The Hague, there is an important letter from Thomas Manningham, who for 4 years had held office as Deputy Grand Master of the Premier Grand Lodge of England, the so-called Moderns. It's a long letter, dated the 12th of July, 1757, just after Manningham had come out of office. And in it he gives the Dutch brethren a very detailed account of English Freemasonry, its make-up, its regalia, its customs, and so on. His letter concludes with this information on toasting procedure. Our healths, that is our toasts, our healths are first, the King and the Craft, with 3 times 3. Second, the Grand Master, with 3 times 3. The Deputy Grand Master and Grand Wardens, with 3. I might mention that at that time these, the Deputy Grand Master and the Grand Wardens, were the old Grand Officers. Then we drink past Grand Masters, foreign brethren of distinction by name, as the Emperor, King of Prussia, etc., and after that, the general toasts of the craft. It seems, too, that in the other Grand Lodge, the Grand Lodge of the Ancients, that had come into existence in 1751 as a rival to the Premier Grand Lodge, it seems that they followed similar customs. On 2 occasions in their minutes in the 1760s, we find a record of toasts being drunk, again with the King and the Craft as the first, and honoured with 9. The same toast also regularly appears as the one to be honoured following the first item in the many collections of songs for use at Masonic meetings, printed in the constitutions of the 2 Grand Lodges and in various other publications. So much, then, for how the unique form of the loyal toast came to figure in the developing system of speculative Freemasonry in the 18th century. But it might be of interest to digress for a few moments to consider its significance as a real expression of the loyalty of the order at times when this might have been called into question, at both ends of the 18th century, when there were suspicions about organizations which, in popular imagination, or indeed in reality, might have been thought of as seditious. There was nervousness, of course, in the first half of the century about the Jacobite cause and its threat to the House of Hanover, so newly settled on the throne of Great Britain, and nervousness again at its end about the spread of the revolutionary ferment from France into this country. Freemasons were at pains to counter these fears and to emphasize their loyalty to the crown. Anderson, in his Constitutions, had made the point that the appeal of the fraternity to those who were flocking to join it in the early 1720s was that the Masonic Lodge provided a safe and pleasant relaxation from intense study or the hurry of business, without politics or party. Without politics or party. But nevertheless, Freemasons throughout the century were, as I've said, at pains to counter fears that it might be thought otherwise, and were anxious to affirm their loyalty. For instance, the London Journal of the 16th of June, 1722, carried a report reflecting this concern, and I'd like to quote it. A few days ago, a select body of the Society of Freemasons waited upon the Right Honourable the Lord Viscount Townshend, one of His Majesty's principal secretaries of state, to signify to his lordship that, being obliged by their constitution to hold a general meeting now at midsummer according to annual custom, they hoped the administration would take no umbrage at that convention, as they were all zealously affected to his majesty's person and government. His lordship received this information in a very affable manner, telling them he believed they need not be apprehensive of any molestation from the government, so long as they went on nothing more dangerous than the ancient secrets of the society, which must be of a very harmless nature, because, as much as mankind love mischief, nobody betrayed them. At the other end of the century, when there were fears over the effect in Britain of the French Revolution, a bill was brought before Parliament in 1799, aimed at the suppression of any societies deemed subversive, or indeed of any that met in secret and administered oaths of any sort. The leaders of the craft naturally became alarmed that if this bill became law, it would apply to lodges of Freemasons. So it was resolved to make representations on the subject to the then Prime Minister, William Pitt. A deputation, headed by the Earl of Moira, Act Master, or as we would call him now, the Programme Master, a deputation waited on the Prime Minister at Downing Street, and in due course reported back to the Hall Committee of the Grand Lodge that they had been very favourably received by him, that he expressed his good opinion of the society, and said he was willing to recommend any clause to prevent the new act from affecting the society, provided that the name of the society could be prevented from being made use of as a cover by evil-disposed persons for seditious purposes. The outcome of this was that lodges of Freemasons were exempted from the provisions of the Unlawful Societies Act of 1799, provided that each year they sent in a return of their members to the Clerk of the Peace for their locality, so that their membership was not in effect kept secret. This all lodgers continued dutifully to do for the next 168 years until 1967, when the 1799 Act was finally repealed. So, to come back finally to the subject of the Loyal Toast itself. The point arising from all this is that at none of the times I have been talking about, covering the whole of the 18th century, when Freemasons were affirming their loyalty to the crown with the toast, "The King and the Craft," at none of these times was the monarch a Freemason. In the 100 years that had started with the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge, the world's first Grand Lodge, saw the rise of the rival Ancients Grand Lodge, and ended with the merging of the two as the United Grand Lodge, 100 years in which Freemasonry was advancing by a continuous process of development, innovation and change into the system we know today, in that 100 years, Britain was ruled over by the first three Georges, none of whom was a Freemason, although 6 sons of George III became Freemasons, and 2 of them, the Dukes of Kent and Sussex, were to play leading parts in bringing about the union of the two Grand Lodges. There's no question, therefore, that when our Masonic forebears of the 18th century were drinking the toast, "The King and the Craft," there's no question that they were drinking his health as a Freemason, the patron of the craft. No, it was a natural expression by Freemasons of the day of the allegiance due to the sovereign of their native land, one of the principles and tenets of the order. And if this became of added importance at the end of the 18th century, and in the middle of the 19th, when revolutionary movements were changing the history of Europe and undermining the fabric of society, if it became of added importance then, how much more important it is surely today, when no opportunity seems to be lost of deriding and dismissing the simple old-fashioned virtues, and when the craft itself is under attack, its character censured, and its integrity impugned. So, whether it is the King and the Craft, or the Queen and the Craft, it is a time immemorial tradition of English Freemasonry, and as such is one of the ancient usages and established customs of the order, and one which, I submit, we should not lightly abandon.